Welcome to the Accounting Web Tax Podcast with Anne Fairpo, brought to you in association with CCH, part of Wolters Kluwer, number one in tax and accounting worldwide.
Hello and welcome to the Accounting Web Tax Podcast for Monday, December the 3rd. We're heading into winter and there's a distinct bite of chills, although it hasn't actually snowed here at Podcast Central yet. Hopefully it's not too bad where you are. Today I'm covering off three principal cases, the Rangers EBD case, much weighted, a case on concession and VAT for small fees for accountancy services, and the ILIF case on intangibles, as well as the usual roundup of snippets and so on as well. Starting with the Rangers case, the first tier tribunal has, perhaps slightly surprisingly, allowed the Rangers EBD case on a two-thirds majority. That said, don't hold your breath for the upper tribunal to follow suit. It's not impossible, but we'll see. HMRC are, of course, bound to appeal on this one. Case reference, if you want to have a look at it, is 2012 UK FTT 692. The case is actually called Murray Group Holdings, but they owned the Rangers Football Club, and this actually affected a number of their companies, but Rangers was the best known. The case has dragged on for years, and I do mean that. The hearings started in October 2010, and they were heard on various days in October and November 2010, then April, May and November 2011, and January 2012. It's taken 10 months since then for the decision to appear. The judges must be sick of it. The case relates to loans from an EBT to players and executives, and it's around the question of whether or not and when income tax and NICs should apply, if at all, in respect of those loans. Obviously, the disguised remuneration rules have killed this particular type of arrangement because PAYE and NICs would now apply immediately. But before those rules were put in place in April 2011, there were quite a few arrangements of this sort around. In this particular case, the trust was set up with a Jersey resident trustee to provide benefits to family members of the employees of the Murray Group companies, including players of the Rangers Football Club. There were at one point 108 sub-trusts, and these were all created and funded with assets from the main trusts. The employees had put in about $55 million in total. Each sub-trust relates to an individual employee or player, and it's for the benefit of their family, but theoretically not for the direct benefit of the employee. Instead, loans were made from the sub-trusts to the employees, usually for most of the value of the sub-trust fund, and they were made without security. There was interest, it was a LIBOR plus 1.5 or 2%. The Jersey regulator seems to have been a bit concerned about the lack of security, and the original trustee delayed some of the loan arrangements. HMRC seemed to have got a little bit more involved at the point where a new trustee was put in place, who doesn't seem to have been quite so worried about the regulator's concern. In some cases, the sub-trusts were put in place instead of payment of a discretionary bonus. According to the judgment, it seems to be particularly clear that there were some discussions of bonuses, although perhaps not actually amounts, and then suddenly a sub-trust came up instead and a loan was made instead of the bonus. Where the sub-trusts were for players, they were usually set up on recruitment or on renegotiation, and the amounts put into the sub-trust were dealt with apparently by way of a sub-letter, which wasn't disclosed to the Scottish FA, or in fact originally to HMRC. Given all this, the club's council had argued that the loans were still not unreservedly placed in the hands of employees and players, and so they couldn't be emoluments in line with the Dexter and Sempra cases. HMRC had argued otherwise, to no one's surprise, and they said the trusts and loans should be disregarded on the Ramsey principle. Reading through the judgment, it's not wholly straightforward. Even the two-thirds majority, though they allowed the appeals in principle, they still found some of the loans to be potentially taxable as earnings. They left the parties to sort these out directly, but still, they agreed that the amounts were not placed unreservedly in the hands of employees. The loans could still be recovered. It was possible to enforce the recovery, even if it was, they said, unlikely. The Ramsey principle, they said, couldn't be applied because they had real legal effects to the trusts and loans. That's a little bit surprising given that the judgment actually outlines a lot of less than exemplary management of arrangements. Besides the change in trustee, when the original started to get a little bit fussy, there were other problems including close matching of payments into the trusts and loans out of the trusts, the concealment of the side letters, as I've mentioned, and close links between bonuses and loans and so on. It's really not actually surprising there was at least one dissenting judgment. So the dissenting member of the tribunal basically took a completely opposite approach. They said the trust and the loan arrangements did put money unreservedly at the disposal of the employees, and that Ramsey principle could be used, even if the loans had real legal effects that were not commercially real. They say that's a minority, it's not the binding judgment at this point, to the extent the first-tier tribunal judgments are at all binding. It does seem the case is going to go straight to appeal, even the majority decisions hedged about with exceptions. but it does allow employers who are still fighting with HMRC over EBTs to have some hope in continuing the fight, particularly when you look at exactly how badly the Murray Group, in fact, implemented all of these arrangements. Next up, we have a case on concession on VAT on small fees for accountancy services. This case involves a solicitor's firm, it's Mondays LLP, and the tax reference is TC02374. But the principles actually hold good for any partnership. Here, the accountants were billing £900 per partner to deal with partners' tax returns and other matters at the solicitor's firm. There's a breakdown schedule in the judgment setting out exactly what each element of the service would cost. Preparation of the tax return itself was costed at £115. The tribunal actually held that only £170 of the total £900 related to preparation of tax returns. The rest related to the partnership tax reserve, largely. The biggest individual element in the schedule was £260 to advise the company accountant on the amounts that should be paid on behalf of a partner from the tax reserves. The solicitor's firm had argued that only the £115 related to the partner tax return, and so the VAT on the remaining £785 of each £900 was input tax of the firm. They then went on to try and get a little bit more by arguing that the input tax on the £115 was de minimis, and so it shouldn't be disallowed under HMRC guidance. You're probably not going to be shocked to learn that HMRC disagreed. They argued that the VAT on the whole £900 related to partner tax returns and should be disallowed in total. They were somewhat helped to this view by the fact that the invoices just described the services as partners' tax returns. The tribunal disregarded the description, noting that it was inaccurate, but do note that HMRC clearly pay attention to it. The tribunal went on to hold that the costs of meeting with each partner and actually preparing their tax returns were personal costs, and the input tax on those elements was not input tax of the firm. In addition, the cost of advising on the amounts to be paid from the tax reserve account was not for a purpose of the partnership business, and so it couldn't be input tax of the partnership. However, the other costs relating to the tax reserves had a dual purpose. The tax reserve account provided working capital for the firm, and as that was a business purpose, the other purpose of ensuring that partners could have paid their tax didn't actually defeat the business purpose, so input tax on these costs could be recovered. The tribunal found there was a single supply of services, or agreed that there was, because in fact that's how it was set out in the invoice, but following section 24.5 of VATA, a single supply can be apportioned between business and non-business elements, so they said you could have recovered the input tax on those bits which were for a business purpose. The de minimis point that was argued by the solicitor's firm comes from an HMRC manual, VIT 13700, which states that HMRC policy is that, in order to avoid disputes over small amounts of tax, the accountancy fees of a sole trade or partnership should normally be claimed in full, subject to the normal rules. The tribunal held this was a concession, really hard for them to decide otherwise, frankly, and that there was still a question over whether the tax tribunal has jurisdiction over concessions or whether judicial review is what's required for these. There are some outstanding cases, Law and Trade Sale Limited particularly, which are being heard on the point. That said, the tribunal decided that even if they did have jurisdiction, the claim couldn't succeed. The amounts had to be looked at in the context of the total invoice for 23 partners and not on a per-partner basis. The judgment then seems to pretty much go on and completely confuse itself with numbers. It talks about the £18,774 in VAT, but that's for several years, and it's on the basis of disallowing the whole lot, which the tribunal has just said is wrong. Each bill each year was for roughly £20,000, and that's the tribunal's roughly, not mine, with VAT for between 15 and 20%, as it was for quite a number of years. The tribunal said it would agree with HMRC if it had jurisdiction that the concession was not intended to cover invoices of this size. But they've just found a majority of that is allowable. Concession would be to apply VAT on roughly, and that's my roughly, £4,000 and not £20,000. It might still be the case that the tribunal thought the concession wasn't intended to apply to this amount either, but they should have said so. It looks as if the tribunal would require the overall VAT to be small before the concession could apply to a part of it, although that's a very questionable reading of the manual. So it looks as if the larger the firm, the harder it is to fall within this concession. And there's a subsidiary moral in here too for accountants. Get the wording on your invoices right. Third case that I want to look at as main case is the ILIF case. This is another attempt to get intangibles into the corporate tax regime to access amortisation, etc. And it's been slapped down for failure of basic IP law. Interesting, this is another case that's failed for basic law, not just tax law. If you remember, we had the recent Vardy case where the payments of dividends, etc., weren't properly done, and so it failed on company law. This was a failure of IP law. Effectively, the companies transferred or tried to transfer unregistered trademarks without also transferring the business to which they're related. And basically, you can't do that under English law, at least according to most IP lawyers. The tribunal didn't leave the judgment there, though they did actually go on to look at the consequences if the IP law hadn't been wrong. Some of its specific IP tax issues, in particular confirmation that treatment of receipts from IP assets isn't significantly different to that of receipts from other assets. Broadly, they followed the principles in the John Lewis case in 2003, which looked at the question of whether or not there was a diminution in value, and said, you know, the indicia of capital payments set down in the John Lewis case was met here as well. Usefully, the judgment confirms that just because a payment arrangement isn't typical for that type of arrangement, it doesn't necessarily affect the tax treatment. HMRC said this was a trademark license and usually make periodic payments for trademark licenses, not a lump sum. And this was a lump sum. And they said that you should treat it as revenue because normally you'd be paying periodic payments. The judgment said that's not how the tax transaction is structured. It's not a lump sum based on royalties or any use of the IP asset. And just because it's atypical doesn't mean it's actually really significant. It can still be a capital payment. However, the more extensive and perhaps useful points look at matters such as unallowable purpose. One of the points that HMRC had argued was that, in effect, that the whole arrangements were to do with loan relationships. This was an unallowable purpose. The tribunal held that actually no. One of the useful points, really useful points that comes out of this, is they looked at it and effectively took the taxpayer's point of view, which was that the amounts that were being paid were market value. And as a consequence, there was no amount in excess of a market value, and so there was no amount to be assessed as being for an unallowable purpose. They seem to have taken the view that unallowable purpose disallowances only are on the excess amounts over and above those amounts which would be allowed on the market value of the loan relationship. If you want more details on loan relationships and unallowable purposes, have a look at CCH's British Tax Reporter. It's 717280. It has a lot more detail in there. The other matter that they looked at, which is perhaps of more general guidance as well, is on the mini-GAR. There's a section in the IP tax rules that effectively denies beneficial treatment if one of the main purposes of the transaction is to get a tax benefit. And the judgment findings here aren't specifically related to the IP tax. In particular, the judgment found that it could take the tax advisor's intention into account in deciding whether a tax advantage was a main purpose of the transaction. This was because the taxpayer company directors actually didn't fully understand the structure when they were asked why certain things were done, in particular why a lump sum payment was taken, for example. They said they didn't know. That's just how it was arranged. So clear point on this one seems to be that, you know, you should make sure that the taxpayer representatives actually understand what's going on. Otherwise, there's a potential danger that tribunals could argue they need to look at the tax advisor's intentions, where they can't tell anything from the taxpayer company directors. Now, really, the question of who's got control at this point starts to raise its head. The judgment here is, of course, obiter. They found that the IP law wasn't dealt with. This is all about if it had actually worked, what would have happened. This isn't a real judgment in that sort of sense. It's anecdotal comments of the judge, for want of a better phrase. It's also first-tier tribunal, so it's not binding on anything. The other point on the mini-GAR is that the judgment also found the judges could compare the transaction to a hypothetical transaction that achieved commercial objectives more effectively. That's a bit of a departure from normal interpretation. Here, there is also the point that you could argue that, in fact, the transaction structure that was put in place wasn't the best one for achieving the commercial objectives that were aimed at. But nevertheless, not clear that the normal mini-GAR interpretation rules allow you to put in a hypothetical and compare to that. So wait and see where these things go. So they're both a bit of a departure from previous interpretation of mini-GARs, and the implications go well beyond the corporate intangibles tax rules. For more information on the GAR generally, you can also have a look at CCH's tax report on 808-100. That's got a lot more detail on GARs there. Coming on to the snippets for this week then. First up, VAT groups can contain non-taxable persons, at least according to the Attorney General. Cases Commission versus Ireland. The opinion actually goes against the Commission, which had argued that Ireland's VAT rules infringe the VAT directive because they allow non-taxable persons to be members of a VAT group. The Attorney General's view is there's nothing in the VAT grouping provisions to support the Commission's case. The Commission has actually brought proceedings against various countries on this point, including the UK, although they'd asked for the opinion on Ireland only as a form of test case. The point's particularly useful for, or important for, passive holding companies that don't supply services to subsidiaries or perform any other activities. Their scope for VAT recoveries depends on being in a VAT group. Next up, HMRC have published some guidance on RTI penalties. It's largely focused on the in-year full payment submissions, the FPSs. These need to be submitted each time an employer pays an employee or pensioner. There is a mopping up submission for information still outstanding at the year end. That has to be submitted by 19th of April. If later, you've got to use an earlier year update submission instead. Late filing penalties kick in automatically if final payments are not reported by 19th of May. What HMRC have confirmed is that there'll be a softish launch. There are going to be no penalties if in-year FPSs are sent in late until April 2014. Bear in mind, of course, this whole thing doesn't kick off until October 2013. It's not that generous. It doesn't mean you get off scot-free because the current penalty process will continue to apply to the year-end anyway, and a penalty will be charged if the relevant information isn't up to date by 19th of May. It's just not an automatic penalty. For the tax year 2012-13, HMRC have said they're not going to charge penalties for inaccuracies identified on in-year FPSs, but for the tax year 2013-14, in-year penalties may apply based on current criteria. Tax year 2012-13 is still a trial year, so it would seem a bit unreasonable for charging penalties when you're still doing a trial. However, anyway, HMRC accept they'll have some discretion over penalties, which they do according to Schedule 24 of FA 2007. They don't always seem to believe it, so worth keeping a copy of this to wave at them if they say otherwise. And finally, the faster working process is not as dead as it might have seemed. That attempt to move along inquiry processes was apparently abandoned in favour of the single compliance process that HMRC are now rolling out. But a new version of faster working seems to be in HMRC's mind. They're lobbying to be given exemptions from speeding limits for cars. The Department of Transport is consulting on allowing speed limit exemptions for services other than the current trio of police, fire and ambulance. There are some reasonably obvious extensions that are being considered, including bomb disposal units, organ transplant vehicles and Coast Guard vehicles. Whether you can speed at sea is another matter, but they do have land vehicles as well. Other applications have been received from the Mountain Rescue Services and Civil Aviation Fire and Rescue Services. These are all laudable and perfectly sensible. There are lives at stake. And then there's the application from HMRC, which is a bit hard to see how this fits in with the general aim of the exemption, which is that they should be available where lives are at risk. HMRC say they need the right to speed in the name of covert surveillance of organised crime. Frankly, I think there are other areas where they should concentrate on speeding up and they don't include the roads. That's it for this week. Have a good rest of the week. Don't forget the Autumn Statement on Wednesday, George Osborne's little starring role, and I'll speak to you all next week.